I want to thank Jim, first of all, for asking me to participate in this conference. As a participant, I always focus more heavily on my own personal study than I do if I'm just coming to listen. And so this gave me a chance to bury myself in realized eschatology. I'm happy that this is almost over. My wife is especially happy that this is almost over. She's tired of hearing about it, and I'm tired of waiting in it. I'm looking forward to stepping away from it for a little while. But it is an issue that is very practical for me. We're dealing with people in Bowling Green, Christians in Bowling Green, who take this position. And so, and we're dealing with college kids who are being exposed to it for the first time and coming to us with questions. And so, this has been very helpful for me, and I appreciate that. Appreciate the other speakers and all the good work that they've done, and appreciate all of the discussion, participation in which we have engaged. It falls on me to talk a little bit about what the radical preterists, the hyper-preterists, as they're being called by people in the denominational world, believe about judgment and destruction. This is another one of those subjects, like every one of the others that we've discussed, that's difficult to pin down because they don't all agree. They don't all teach exactly the same things about the end and whether or not we will be judged. But they do raise many of the same questions. For example, does the New Testament teach that Jesus is coming back bodily and personally at some unknown time in the future? We've already discussed that in some detail, and looking at Acts chapter 1. And if so, does it also teach that his coming will result in the literal destruction of all physical creation and the subsequent judgment of all human beings, both good and evil, whoever lived? And most of the radical preterists, and I'm using the term radical to distinguish from other forms of preterism, partial preterism. Kevin suggested, and I think rightly so, that all of us would be, to some extent, partial preterists. But this preterism, this realized eschatology, is in the process of evolving. It's evolved a lot, and it is considerably different, and it's gone considerably further from where Max King and his father-in-law began this process back in the early 1970s. And so, among the radical preterists, the contention generally, not universally, but generally speaking, is that there is no teaching in the Bible about an end of the world at all. That the Bible just doesn't say anything about the end of the world. And certainly doesn't say anything about a judgment that's going to take place. And then there are also some disagreements among the radical preterists about what happens to people who aren't Christians, or who are not in a right relationship with God. What happens to people who die outside of Christ? And we'll talk about that a little bit later on. Some of them believe that there is an eternal conscious punishment of the evil, and others have adopted, and it seems like this is becoming more and more common, an annihilationist position. So we'll talk about that as we move along a little further through the outline. We'll try to do four things in part. In the lecture, and we deal with all of these things in a little bit more detail in the outline. And incidentally, the outline I had to have in about a month or so ago. It's already been revised about four times since I sent it in. Not major revision, but I have made some changes. And what we talk about today will reflect some of those changes. But we want to look at just a few of the New Testament passages that play a role in this discussion. There are a number of passages with which the preterists deal, but I'm going to focus on two primarily in this lesson, Matthew 25, 31 through 46, the separation of the sheep from the goats, and then have some things to say about 2 Peter chapter 3. So those are the two passages that we'll focus primarily on. I want us to think for a few minutes about why I believe those passages must be looking to and pointing toward the final destruction of the earth and the ushering in of a universal judgment. I want to comment just very briefly, and it's been referenced, but not much has been said about the Apostolic Fathers and their understanding of these things. I want to just make a comment or two about that, and then I want to spend a few minutes looking at this annihilationist position. that seems to be, when you look at the web pages, when you look at Dawson's book, Essays on Eschatology, he very clearly has adopted the annihilationist position, and that seems to be spreading. That seems to be becoming a little bit more common among the radical preterists in this movement. I want us to think for a few minutes about Matthew chapter 25. We've already talked about the first part of the Olivet Discourse. I mentioned yesterday in the question and answer session that I have read in a number of different places from people who are responding to Don Preston, especially in the denominational world. And biblical scholars in the denominational world are beginning to respond to Preston. Many of them believe that the issue resides in the Olivet Discourse, that a proper understanding of what Jesus is teaching, how he's answering those questions in Matthew chapters 24 and 25 is really the key to dealing with Preston and others' position on the end of time and whether or not there's going to be a judgment. Gary didn't reference Kick, but I will, Marcellus Kick. I'll quote him a couple of times. If you don't have Kick's book, I would recommend it. You can. He wrote two books. He wrote one on Matthew chapter 24, and it's called Matthew 24. And he wrote one on Revelation chapter 20 that's called Revelation 20. I have those two books. I've had them for a long time. They've been combined into one volume now, and I can't remember what it's called. Eschatology of Victory. And so you can get them both in one volume. I like his writing in Matthew chapter 24. I like that book better than the Revelation chapter 20 book. So I'm not necessarily recommending that second one. But I came in contact with Kick's works many years ago, not long after I first started preaching. And in wrestling with Matthew chapter 24 and 25 and what's Jesus teaching and what are the questions that he's answering. And Kick made a lot of sense to me. Especially talking about Matthew chapter 24 and verse 36 being, I think, what he calls the transition text. That Jesus changes gears there, and the language is different from there on. But about this particular part of the Olivet Discourse, which he discusses very briefly in that book on Matthew 24, Kick says the picture of the last judgment in these verses forms one of the most impressive and breathtaking passages of the Bible. The glorious and triumphant coming of the Lord will terminate history and inaugurate the final judgment at which all people who have dwelt upon the earth will be present. I think that's a good assessment, just a good brief assessment of what's going on in Matthew chapter 25. We're not going to take the time for the sake of time to read those verses. I know all of you all are well acquainted with them and you've preached sermons on the separation of the sheep from the goats and what the criteria were and all of the other things that are associated with that. What I want to do in thinking about how to respond to the preterist contention that Matthew chapter 25, 31 through 46, the separation of the sheep from the goats, is talking about, like everything else, the destruction of Jerusalem. That the judgment there is talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. And that this is just another way of expressing on the part of Jesus what it's going to be like when Jerusalem is destroyed. There is a marked contrast between the two judgments that are described, I believe, in the Olivet Discourse. And Gary talked about the judgment of Matthew chapter 24 last night. In that part of the Olivet Discourse, up through verse 35, where he's talking about the destruction of Jerusalem, and I think clearly talking about the destruction of Jerusalem, the language is local. He's describing a local judgment, and one that's confined to a specific geographic area, Jerusalem and its environs. For example, he talks about the abomination of desolation standing in the holy place. That would only mean something to people who had access to the holy place or who could see the holy place. That wouldn't mean anything to someone who lived in a different part of even Judea necessarily, but the world in Athens or Rome or Corinth or Carthage or any place else in the world, the significance of seeing the abomination of desolation set up in the holy place would mean nothing to them at all. And the admonition to flee to the mountains. Again, it might be that people in other parts of the world were aware of what was going on in Jerusalem or vaguely aware of what was going on in Jerusalem, but there wouldn't be any need for flight on the part of anybody who wasn't actually there on site. The only people who would have to fear for their lives would be the people who were in the presence of the Roman army. That kind of language, it seems to me, dominates the judgment scene that's being described in Matthew chapter 24. In Matthew chapter 25, it's different, and the language is different. This judgment scene of the separation of the sheep and the goats is very much universal in nature. For example, in verse 32, all the nations are said to be gathered before Him. Incidentally, the preterist position is that all nations refers to all of the Jewish tribes, all of the Jewish nations, all of the various Jewish tribes in and around Palestine. But it doesn't say that. It just says all nations would be gathered before Him. The separation takes place among all the nations. And the criteria for judgment doesn't have anything at all to do with anything that is uniquely Jewish. In other words, the criteria for judgment doesn't have anything to do with worship at the temple, doesn't have anything to do with offering sacrifices, doesn't have anything to do with anything that can be considered to be uniquely Jewish. It has to do with things that we commonly approach and we commonly deal with on a daily basis. How do we treat other people? How do we serve other people? And so there's nothing in the judgment that would indicate in any way, it doesn't seem to me at least, as though there would be anything uniquely Jewish about that. And so Kick's conclusion about this part of the Olivet Discourse is that in one, the judgments are executed upon the earth. In the other, the scene is in heaven, and the contrast is obvious. This is a universal, worldwide judgment. And nothing about the separation of the sheep from the goats has anything uniquely to do with the Jewish nation, or being a Jew, or participating or engaging in Jewish ceremonies or festivities at all. That is consistent with what many other passages in the New Testament teach. I understand that the preterists interpret all of these in different ways. But the fact of the matter is, for example, in 1 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 5, therefore do not pronounce judgment before the time, or before the Lord comes, who will bring to light the things now hidden in darkness, and will disclose the purposes of the heart. Then each one will receive his commendation from God. Each one will receive his commendation from God. And again, that's being written to people who lived hundreds of miles from Jerusalem. And to whom the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem would really probably have little or no impact in their daily lives at all. No special impact anyway. They're a long way away. Or Paul to Timothy in 1 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 1, I charge you in the presence of God and of Christ Jesus, who is to judge the living and the dead, and by His appearing in His kingdom, to judge the living and the dead. Again, the universal language. For the Son of Man is going to come with His angels in the glory of His Father, and then He will repay each person according to what He has done. That kind of language is consistent in the Scriptures. That there will be a judgment, not a local judgment, like the judgment on Jerusalem, which very clearly is being discussed, I think, in Matthew chapter 24, but a judgment at the end of the time that will involve all people, living and dead, good and bad, each one, each person, being judged by God according to the things that they've done in this world. One of the things that you can do when you're talking about Matthew, I knew I would do that consistently, bang on the stand. One of the things that you can do is you can go to Revelation chapter 20, verses 11 through 15, and see very similar language. Where John is talking about, I think, exactly the same thing about which Jesus was talking in Matthew chapter 25. John sees the dead, small and great, standing before the throne in verse 12. And these dead, according to John, come from everywhere, including the sea and Hades. And Hughes in his commentary suggests that the manner and the place of their dying make no difference. It matters not whether they were drowned at sea or consumed by fire or devoured by wild beasts or whether they succumbed through illness or old age. All are given up to judgment. And I think that's exactly right. You have in Matthew chapter 25, verses 31 through 46, a picture of a universal judgment. everyone involved. Criteria that don't involve anything uniquely Jewish. Same thing in Revelation chapter 20, verses 11 through 15. Wayne Jackson says about that prophecy in Revelation chapter 20, here is a prophecy concerning the judgment day, yet the passing away of heaven and earth occurs simultaneous with this event. These things are not in the past, they are still in the future. And so Matthew chapter 25 is talking about, I believe, a universal judgment. A judgment on all people that's going to occur at the end of the world. I've been interested, you know, just listening to all the things that the speakers have had to say and the comments that people have made about how do we get to interpreting those things differently. One of the things I've thought about in connection with, and we're going to look at, we're going to move on and look at some other passages as well, that it just is so clear that these passages are talking about a universal judgment. I remember hearing older gospel preachers, and especially those guys who debated and read it in debates, and hear them say that you know, that this is so clear that you just have to have help to misunderstand it. I think that's exactly the position in which at least I find myself when I look at passages like Matthew chapter 25. Verses 31 through 46, Revelation chapter 20, the judgment scene there. How would the average person have read it? What would they have understood? Ephesians chapter 5, we are commanded to understand what the will of God is. It's written in such a way that it can be understood. I don't know, does anybody here feel like you have a clear understanding of almost anything that we've talked about during the course of the last few days? And again, some of these guys have been buried in this longer than I have, and I have for a number of weeks. And I come away just almost in despair after every session that it just doesn't make any sense. It cannot possibly be what the average normal person would have understood when he read these passages. I think that's a powerful argument. That you have to have considerable help to get to where the radical preterists are. And many of them are happy to offer the help. When we read Matthew chapter 25, verses 31 through 46, I am absolutely convinced that the average person would read that and understand this is talking about something that's going to take. Jesus is talking about what it's going to be like when he comes back at the end of the world. And Revelation chapter 20 as well. And having said that, if that's true about Matthew chapter 25, I think it's especially true about 2 Peter chapter 3. And as a matter of fact, again, looking on some of the websites that the denominational folks are building and putting up to respond to this realized eschatology, to radical or what some of them are calling hyper-preterism. And many of you know, understand, many of these people are premillennial. They have an ulterior motive for arguing that that these preterists, these people who promote what RE is that what we're saying? That's what we're calling it. Is that our code word now among ourselves for realized eschatology? When I see you or send you an email, if I just put RE on there, everybody would know exactly what. Okay, that's cool. You know, clubs ought to have secrets like that. We ought to have, yeah, there ought to be encoded messages like that. Nobody told me, I didn't know, or I would have included that in some of my slides too. And I probably will go back and add some of that later on. What these guys are doing, interesting to me, a lot of them are focusing really heavy attention on 2 Peter chapter 3. There's a Baptist who has a website, and again, he's defending premillennialism, but he contends that really all you need to do to destroy their teaching about judgment, what's going to happen at the end of times, is you need to show what 2 Peter chapter 3 really teaches. What's the point of 2 Peter chapter 3? Is it language that could reasonably be used to talk about the destruction of Jerusalem? Or is there something more to it than that? Wayne Jackson contends that 2 Peter chapter 3 is the most comprehensive discussion of the matter of end times. And that's exactly right. The most detailed, the most complete, the most comprehensive discussion of what's going to happen at the end of time is found in 2 Peter chapter 3. This is one of the things that Sam Dawson had to say about it in the book. I haven't read the whole book, by the way. I appreciate Kevin calling that book to my attention. I wasn't even aware of its existence, and Kevin pointed it out to me. It killed me to buy it. And I've been trying to figure out how we could just, maybe we could buy one copy and pass it around and not have to support Sam in the publishing of that. But anyway, I do think it's a book that we're going to have. We're going to have to read it. We're going to have to answer it. We're going to have to know what it says. It does seem to be being referenced on a lot of the preterist websites. Dawson is quoted just almost everywhere from that book. And so I think we're going to have to know it. I haven't read it all yet. I tried to focus on the sections of his book that dealt primarily with this particular issue. This is one of the things that he says about 2 Peter chapter 3, that the purpose of Peter's words in this chapter was to warn faithful people of his time concerning the approaching physical judgment so they could escape it. And so Dawson's position essentially is this. This letter is being written primarily, if not exclusively, to the Palestinian Jewish Christians. And it's being written to warn them of this approaching physical danger so that they can escape it. And if that's true, then it's difficult to imagine what value this letter would have to a Christian who lived outside of Palestine. Or to a Christian who was not Jewish or didn't have a Jewish background. Because it's written to warn those particular people, Dawson says, about the end of times. And that's basically the position that Max King took as well. Thus, the world reserved unto fire against the day of judgment and perdition of godly men. That should be 2 Peter chapter 3 and verse 7, by the way. Was the Jewish world. Fiery judgment was going to fall on Judaism. And so the preterist position is that all of the events of 2 Peter chapter 3, all of the teaching of 2 Peter chapter 3 has to do with the destruction of Jerusalem. I want us to look at some things in 2 Peter chapter 3 and notice how we would respond to that. What is it that Peter is saying in 2 Peter chapter 3? About what is he talking? It's interesting to me, this letter, most scholars believe that this letter was written very late in Peter's life. I suspect that that's probably right. And if that's so, it means it was written in somewhere around the mid-60s. Which means it's only a few years before the end. It's only a few years before the destruction of Jerusalem. Now, the preterists would contend that that means that this letter was written a very short time before the end, before the last days were culminated. But it's interesting that you don't get that impression reading 2 Peter chapter 3. You don't get the impression that Peter is suggesting that this destruction is imminent or this destruction is near, that it's about to happen. Like an air raid siren going off almost and people diving for cover, you would almost expect that if Peter had any sense at all, if the preterist position is right, then Peter had to know that it was coming shortly. It was very soon. You don't get that impression at all. As a matter of fact, you get just the opposite impression reading 2 Peter chapter 3. He quotes, or at least alludes to, Psalm 90 and verse 4, in verse 8, he says, "Do not let this one fact escape your notice, beloved, that with the Lord one day is like 1,000 years, and 1,000 years like one day." The New American Standard rendition of Psalm 90 and verse 4 is, "For 1,000 years in your sight are like yesterday when it passes by, or as a watch in the night." So not a direct quotation, but certainly a strong allusion to Psalm chapter 90 and verse 4. So what's the point that Peter's making in talking about one time as far as God is concerned? I would suggest that he's reminding his readers to be patient. That they've waited for a long time for Christ to come again. It's been nearly 40 years and he hasn't come. And that Peter's telling them, just be patient. The fact that he hasn't come yet doesn't mean that he's not coming. The word slack is just a simple word. It means, we understand what it means in English. It means exactly the same thing in Greek. It means to tarry or to delay or to be slow, to retard, to tarry or to loiter. In other words, as some of the scoffers were saying that Peter references, where is the promise of his coming? Where is he? He went away a long time ago and he said he was coming back. And Peter's response to that is, that God keeps His promises, and we need to be patient. The fact that He hasn't come back doesn't mean that He's not coming back. And so Peter references time. He references time and God in His dealings with time. Well, why talk about that? Why counsel patience if Peter knows and understands that the end actually is very near? What would be the thing to say to the scoffers? Where is the promise of His coming? If Peter knows that it's just a few years away, you just wait. You know, well, you just wait. Yeah, and you'll see that God keeps His promises. Because it's just about to happen. That would have been the perfect response to scoffers. But He didn't say that. What He says is, don't take any regard or don't take any consideration of the time involved. Time doesn't mean anything to God. What means something to God is faithfulness. God is not slack concerning His promise, as some count slackness. And Peter even suggests there's a reason why he's waiting. Why is he taking so long? Because God is long-suffering, not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. And incidentally, that, and maybe that's something that we'll talk about in the discussion, But that in and of itself doesn't make sense to me if the preterists are right. There was no repentance for Israel, for Jerusalem. Jerusalem is going to be destroyed. God's already determined that that's going to take place. But Peter says in 2 Peter chapter 3 and verse 9, the reason he's waiting is because he wants them to be saved, not willing that any should perish, but that all should be saved. That doesn't seem to be consistent to me. And so we ask, how could Peter not have known that the destruction was coming so soon? Why didn't he remind his audience that the second coming is just about to occur? Why does he not remind the believers that Jesus said he would come within their lifetimes? If he's talking about the same coming in 2 Peter chapter 3 that he was talking about in the first part of the Olivet Discourse, and that he's talking about in other places, then again, all Peter has to do is just tell them it's about to happen. It's coming, but he doesn't. Instead, he talks about God's patience, God's timing, thousands of years as being just a day to God. In other words, that's not how God counts time, as some of the sects say, that's, you know, one day equals 1,000 years. The point is that time doesn't mean anything to God, and especially in His promises. God keeps His promises. He always keeps His promises. He's faithful to keep His promises, but He does it in His own good time. And He will, Peter says, keep this particular promise. The preterist position then on 2 Peter chapter 3 basically is this, that the heavens and the earth that are to be destroyed by burning refers to the fall of Judaism or the Jewish world. Max King also references Matthew 3 and 13, 2 Thessalonians chapter 1 and verse 8, to refer to the symbolic fire in the destruction of Judaism. There are some problems, I think, inherent in that particular position. One of them is the word that Peter uses several times in this text, in 1 Peter, 2 Peter chapter 3, and it's the word that's translated earth. And generally speaking, this word carries with it the idea of earth as arable land. It's the same word that Paul used in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and verse 47. The first man is from the earth, earthy, and the second man is from heaven, where Paul's point is that the first man was made out of physical or earthly material. And so it doesn't seem in the text as though there's any reason to believe that earth is just a symbolic word that really doesn't mean earth. What it means is just a tiny little part of the earth, and just one little speck on the earth, just Jerusalem. that when he talks about the earth, he's talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. That he uses a word that in other places refers to the physical creation, all physical material. I want to focus on this particular word. I actually went online to see if I could figure out how to pronounce this. Stoichion? Is that close? And I think you know, at least, you know, dictionary.com, the lady told me that that's the way it was pronounced. When I punched the button and, you know, she said it, that's the way she said it. So I'm going to assume that that's the case. The word stoichion appears in 2 Peter chapter 3. He uses it twice. That word appears in verse 10 and it appears again in verse 12. It's translated as elements in the New American Standard Translation. The English Standard Version renders it as heavenly bodies. The preterist's argument is this, that the word stoichion appears seven times in the New Testament. And that's every listed there on the slide is every usage of the word stoichion in the New Testament. The preterist argument is this, that every time that word appears in all of the other usages, in all the other times, the other five times that it appears in the New Testament outside of 2 Peter, it always carries with it the idea of the elements, the principles of Judaism. The elements or the makeup of Judaism. And so I looked up the word, and just like, you know, somebody else said, the only way I have of knowing what these words mean and how they're used is to try to consult some of the scholars. And the scholars say that in classical Greek, the word stoichion was part of a series, the basic parts of which make up something larger. Thayer says, and this is his first definition of the term stoichion, any first thing from which the others belonging to some series or composite whole take their rise, an element or a first principle. Now, he illustrates that with the letters of the alphabet. You know, each letter of the alphabet is a part, it is an element of the alphabet. But no letter by itself is the alphabet. A is just a part of the alphabet, happens to be the first. In a series of similar objects, that when you put them all together, all of that makes up or creates the alphabet. And so Thayer says that usages include the letters of the alphabet, the elements from which all things have come, the material causes of the universe, and the heavenly bodies. Now, again, the preterist argument is that every other time that word is used, and that should be five usages, because it's two of the seven are in 2 Peter. But every other time that word is used in the New Testament, they argue, you do not get the idea that the word elements refers to the scientific idea of elements of matter, all the atoms of the universe, or the periodic table of elements. Preterists contend that in those other passages, they refer to the elements of the Jewish religion or worldly philosophy and conclude that it must also have that meaning in 2 Peter chapter 3. Let me suggest to you what I think the flaw of that reasoning is. This goes back to what Gary said in his lecture last night. That fails to take into consideration the context in which Peter uses the word here. It is not a valid principle of reasoning in Greek, in English, or any other language that I know of, that a word must always have exactly the same meaning every time it is used in every context. Words can mean different things. And as a matter of fact, I tried to think of ways to illustrate that. We use the word love in a number of different contexts, and it doesn't always mean the same thing every time we say it. If I say to the banana split at Dairy Queen, I love you, I don't mean exactly the same thing as when I say to my wife, I love you. At least I better not mean exactly the same thing by the use of that word. Or if I say to you, which I would say to all of you, I love you guys, I wouldn't mean exactly the same thing by saying that to you as I would say to my son, I love you, son. The context determines how we're using the word. And as a matter of fact, in English, we even use the word love as a synonym for sex. We talk about making love. And what we mean by that is having sex, having a sexual relationship. And usually the context is what determines. What did I mean by that word? You know, I would hope, you know, if I told some of you guys I love you, I would hope you would understand the context. Please understand the context in which I would be saying that. And that I would mean it in the context of brotherly love. I think the same thing is true with a word like stoikon. Must it mean exactly what it means every other time it's used in the New Testament? No. As a matter of fact, Peter, he tells us what he means. If this word means the elements, the parts, the particles that make up a whole, what is the whole of which these things are the parts? It is the earth and the works that are in it. And so the earth as a whole, and all the parts of the earth, every aspect of physical creation, all of that is going to be destroyed, the earth and its works. Peter, he doesn't even leave it to us to try to, you know, use detective work and figure out how does this fit into the context. He tells us exactly. Here's what I mean by that word. What do I mean by particles, by elements, by small pieces? I mean the small pieces that all together compose or make up the earth and its works. And so the argument is flawed because it fails to take into consideration the context. Also, since these things will be destroyed, we are looking for a new heavens and a new earth. I think it would have been interesting. I hope we don't in the question and answer session, but I think it would be an interesting discussion. What's this? What's the eschatological? What are the eschatological implications of the new heavens and the new earth? I think that's interesting. That's intriguing. But whatever it is, it's something that's going to replace the old heavens and the old earth. What are the old heavens and the old earth? It's this. It's what we see around us. All the parts of that are going to be melted, burned up, dissolved, Peter says in 2 Peter chapter 3. And a legitimate question to ask, I think, is how does any of that fit the Jewish system anyway? I mean, what does any of that have to do with Judaism? And what they try to do is they just try to connect, well, the Romans burned the city. And so you got fire in both passages, which means that there must be a connection there. But and we've talked about how they try to make those connections. In verse 5, out of water and by water. The natural reading of that would be that he's talking about what? Water? You think he's talking about water there? You know, the world it was made out of water and by water. The cosmos is the Greek word that's used there, primarily order or arrangement. It's used to denote the earth in contrast to heaven. It is the earth that was flooded with water in Noah's day. How does that fit the Jewish system? You know, just as the earth was, you know, flooded with water in Noah's day, the earth now is going to be destroyed by fire, reserved for fire. Well, again, how does that? What did water have to do? What did water ever have to do with Jerusalem? I can't remember a time. Maybe I'm missing something. I can't remember a time when Jerusalem was ever flooded. I think I understand, underwater, in other words. Well, I can think of one time, I guess, when the place where Jerusalem ended up being built would have been underwater. But it would take, if you've ever been there, it is so high up. Going up to Jerusalem is not a euphemism. I mean, literally, from any direction, you go up to Jerusalem. There's no way that water could have ever been associated in any way. It's talking about literal things. This has been mentioned already, but the day of the Lord would come like a thief in the night. Seems to me as though there's nothing about the thief in the destruction of Jerusalem. They knew it was coming. And they were given signs, as a matter of fact, to tell them when it was coming. You'll know that it's coming when you see these particular signs taking place. And so that's different. The new heavens and the new earth follows the destruction of the present heavens and the present earth. Peter says in 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 4 that it's reserved in heaven. When Jesus returns, not only will all evil and sin be destroyed, but the earth as we know it now will likewise be destroyed and will be replaced with something better called new heavens and new earth. And characteristic of that new heavens and new earth, I believe, in Revelation chapters 21 and 22, and I know that some differ with this. I have close friends who interpret Revelation chapters 21 and 22 to be an ideal picture of the church in the world. And that may be how some of you interpret it. I'm sorry that you're wrong about that, but or at least I would. My judgment is that it is much too ideal a picture to be talking about the church in any sense in the world. That's talking about heaven. The new heavens and the new earth will be perfect. No more disease, no more death, crying, sorrow, all suffering removed. Again, in 2 Peter chapter 3, there's nothing about this that fits the Jewish system or the destruction of the Jewish system in any way. The final consummation is a worldwide event. 10 minutes. Covers the entire globe. Cannot be limited to Palestine or even the Roman Empire in AD 70. Wayne Jackson again, the language of 2 Peter chapter 3 is far too grand for that. In other words, the preterist interpretation that this passage is dealing with just the destruction of Jerusalem. I agree with that completely. And I do think there's some merit in focusing on just one passage like this. Rather than jumping around from Matthew to Acts to John to Corinthians to Peter, I think that some of the denominational people have hit a solid point here. That if we can pin it down here, then that answers all of the other passages too. If we can show people that the language of 2 Peter chapter 3 cannot possibly be referring to a local destruction at just one point in time in history, but that it's talking about a universal destruction of all things and the end of the world, then we've taken that peg, that leg out from under, what are we talking about here? Radical, realized eschatology. R-E, I should have remembered that. I want to just very quickly touch on this. It's already been mentioned. Acts chapter 17, Peter's sermon, I think Kevin mentioned this, Peter's sermon to the Athenians, that God has fixed a day in which He will judge the world in righteousness through a man He has appointed, the preterists say. That's talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. But the fall of Jerusalem would have absolutely no impact on the Athenians at all. I used one of the map programs and just drew a line from Athens to Jerusalem. It's 800 miles as the crow flies. What would there be about the destruction of Jerusalem that would compel the Athenians to repent? Now, what could there possibly be in the destruction of Jerusalem that would compel the Athenians, who had no tie or connection to Judaism at all, except that, you know, as Jewish people conducted business or lived in their city or passed through, what would the destruction of Jerusalem have to say to them? Paul says they ought to repent because of this coming judgment. And such a warning is nonsense to the Athenians if it refers only to a local judgment against a specific race of people in a faraway land. And that's the point that the preterists make, though. Acts chapter 17, every time you see some reference to the day or the last day or the end, he's talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. You can say the same thing about Acts 24, 25, which I think, Kevin, you mentioned this one also too, didn't you? That as he was discussing righteousness, self-control, and judgment to come, Felix became frightened. Frightened about what? You know, and it's difficult to imagine why preaching about a judgment to come would cause someone in Felix's position to be afraid. The quote from Jackson, why would a Roman be terrified with reference to the impending destruction of Judaism when he would be on the winning side and not the losing? If Paul's talking to Felix about the destruction of Jerusalem, then Felix's response would naturally have been, so what? Why do I care about that? What does that mean to me? But that's not how he reacted. The text says that he was terrified. I want to skip over some of this to get to something else. I did run across this, and I like this. It's in a book that McGuigan wrote that doesn't have anything to do with realized eschatology, but it's a great little book, The Kingdom of God and the Planet Earth. And he talks about characteristics of the judgment. And he makes these points. The return of Christ will be to judge the world. This judgment is declarative. It's not to determine who will be condemned and who won't. That's known already. Those who belong to Christ will be found blameless in that day. The judgment will be universal. And Acts 17 and Matthew 25, 2 Peter 3, a number of other passages that we could use. The coming of Christ will result in the resurrection of the dead and the glorious transformation of the righteous, which we talked about in the last lesson. And the coming of Christ marks the end of the expression of the reign of Christ and of God. Now ruling with delegated authority, the power that he currently exercises, McGuigan says, is mediatorial power due to his work as Redeemer and Mediator. And when the end comes, he will deliver up to the kingdom to the Father. So this is the conclusion that McGuigan draws. And it's a biblical, accurate, precise conclusion. The story of the future then goes so far like this. Christ returns visibly, bodily, and personally. All of the dead arise simultaneously. The living are transformed. The saints to receive glory in that transformation. The judgment takes place and everyone receives his reward. And Christ then, as his last act of submission in the present arrangement, surrenders the rule that was given to him by the Father. That'll preach. I've preached it. That'll preach. And I think I included that just to because I thought that was a good, concise, positive expression. We've been talking about how can we positively teach, or what can we positively teach to help inoculate people? I think that'll work. And I don't know if that book's still in print or available. Does anybody or not? I've had it for years. It's still available. I'm just going to show you Almon Williams' quote. You've seen it if you've looked at the lecture. Who am I to challenge Almon Williams about anything? Brother Williams, he says in his lecture, I undertook an extensive research of the Apostolic Fathers. In other words, Brother Williams thought, if we can find preterism in the writings of the Apostolic Fathers, then that would be a compelling argument in their favor. This is the conclusion that he draws. Since then, there is not even a single extant voice among them in favor of realized eschatology. Most people will find it very difficult to believe that this third generation could be all wrong about these matters, especially when some of them, for example, Polycarp, probably knew some of the apostles. That is, if the AD 70 doctrine were the New Testament doctrine, to believe that by AD 90 to AD 150, a complete blackout of such had taken place is very difficult to believe, if not impossible. This degree of doubt is even increased beyond the bounds of possible belief whenever one considers that if the pre-AD 70 Christian believed in an AD 70 eschatology, they must have made it their best-kept secret, because their successors of the second and third generation show absolutely no acquaintance with it. That, brethren, I think is an incredibly powerful argument. And, I wish I'd had more time to talk about this. Annihilationism, and maybe we will talk about it in the question and answer session. C.S. Lewis said, and I wholeheartedly endorse this, if there was anything that we could give up, this would be one of those things at or near the top of the list. But Lewis said we can't. You know, we can't give it up. It has the full support of Scripture, and especially of our Lord's own words. It has always been held by Christendom, and it has the support of reason. I think that's exactly right. In spite of that, what we're hearing now, and you'll see it if you read Dawson's book, is we're seeing annihilationist views being promoted. The idea is that sinners are destroyed or simply cease to exist at their death. When saints die, they are given a soul. That's called conditional immortality. Or that's what Ed Fudge calls it, at least. Conditional immortality. We don't have eternal souls now. Nobody does. But when the righteous die, they will be given or granted an eternal soul, and the wicked won't, so they will just cease to exist. Here are some people who promote and promoted in their writings annihilationism. F.F. Bruce. All of us have used F.F. Bruce in our teaching and preaching at some point or another. Michael Green, Clark Pinnock, W. Graham Scroggie, John R.W. Stott was an annihilationist, N.T. Wright, and John Wenham. Among us, it started with Ed Fudge. Wrote a book in 1982 in defense of annihilationism called The Fire That Consumes. Currently in its third edition, fully updated, revised, and expanded. I haven't read the new one yet. There is an extensive interview with Fudge on the Planet Preterist website. I document that in the outline. Fudge says he's not a preterist, but his book is a popular resource among radical preterists in their effort to defend the annihilationist position that many of them are coming to occupy. If, in case you didn't know, a movie has been made about Ed Fudge. It's called Hell and Mr. Fudge. Kind of sounded like the ghost and Mrs. Muir to me. Hell, and it was made by Seventh-day Adventists, seriously. You can go to this webpage, hellandmrfudge.com, and you can see a video clip from the movie. You can look at the cast. Young Ed Fudge is played by so-and-so, current Ed Fudge, you know. And Arvid McGuire is played by, and Benny Lee Fudge is portrayed by. And, you know, this on this slide, that's stuff from the webpage. The ultimate certainty, death. The ultimate uncertainty, eternity. The ultimate fear, judgment and beyond. One man discovers answers that changed his mind and his life. I can't imagine our college kids or high school kids or anybody going to a theater to see this. But it's coming out sometime next year. Thank you all very much.